From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we feature two writers familiar to public radio listeners. Daniel Pinkwater has written over 60 books for children and the young at heart. His latest, The Artsy Smartsy Club, is the third in his trilogy of Hoboken chicken stories. He'll tell us about his own childhood. Also, Sarah Vowell. She recently was the voice of daughter Violet in The Incredibles. Her new book, Assassination Vacation, chronicles her visits to the gravesites and monuments honoring Presidents Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Palindromes, the new film by director Todd Solondz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Daniel Pinkwater, is a prolific writer of children's books. His latest, The Artsy Smartsy Club, comes out in May. His voice may be familiar to you from his commentaries on NPR's All Things Considered and on Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. He also wrote and narrated a very funny satire of NPR called A Scugiazzi Christmas. It was loosely based on the story A Christmas Carol and starred Kartok's Maliazzi brothers. Tom and Ray Maliazzi have described Pinkwater by saying, "Pinkwater is nuts." In People magazine, Pinkwater was described as, quote, "one part Marx brother and one part cracked social satirist, with a particle of werewolf thrown in," unquote. Terry spoke with Pinkwater last summer about his book, Looking for Bobowitz, which, like many of his books, is illustrated by his wife, Jill Pinkwater. Here's how the book starts.
On Friday, I had my last day at Happy Valley Elementary School. On Saturday, the moving truck came and took all our stuff to Hoboken, New Jersey, and we left our house in Happy Valley forever. On Sunday, our first day in the new house, the temperature was 100 degrees Fahrenheit, the beginning of the hottest heat wave ever recorded in Hoboken in the month of June for 120 years. 120 years ago is when our Hoboken house had been built. This is what my parents did. They gave up a modern house in Happy Valley, New Jersey, a house with a front yard, a backyard, and trees, on a street with similar houses and similar trees, to move to a brick house with no front yard, practically no backyard, and no trees, on a street with guys sitting on the steps drinking cans of beer and spitting on the sidewalk, and cars and buses running right past our door, and the Hoboken house was in rotten condition and cost three times as much as we got for our Happy Valley house. My parents said we were going to fix up the house and have an urban lifestyle. This is what an urban lifestyle is. My bike was stolen the first hour we were in town, and it was 100 degrees Fahrenheit. My mother said she didn't want me growing up in a suburb. She said life was real in cities. I went upstairs to sit in my crummy 120-year-old room.
Yes, a lot of us are familiar with that particular brand of urban lifestyle.
Yes.
But what are some of the cool things your character ends up finding in the city?
Well, first of all, he finds friends, which is actually what the book is about. He finds friends. It happens this kid, whose nickname is Nick, it has a collection of old... Does anyone remember Classics comics? Do you remember
them? Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
Great things to learn to read with, you know, and it's basically, for those who don't know, regular comic books looking like comic books. They cost a dime, color comics, 52 pages, two staples. But the stories were Treasure Island and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Hunchback of Notre Dame, etc., etc. So he's got a stash of... They're out of print now. You can't get them. Or you, maybe you can get him. He's got his father's old Classics comics, and they're his pride and joy. And it turns out the two kids who live in the apartment house next door also are into Classics comics, and that's the beginning of the friendship.
And he finds a pirate radio station also.
There's a pirate radio station in Hoboken, and it's a guy who plays old cowboy songs and blues and hillbilly music. All 78s, and he's operating from, here's where I mix historic fact and fiction, he's operating from the house in which Guglielmo Marconi lived, which really exists. He really lived there in Hoboken, the guy who invented radio. So the kids are into literature via the Classics comics and learning about American music via the pirate radio station, and that's as much as I care to say about that.
Okay.
Read the book.
Is childhood a place you'd like to return to? Like, when you look back on childhood, was that a good time or a bad time?
It was good and bad. It's like life. You know, people ask me if I like children, and I say, you know, is that a case-by-case basis? What I do is I like to revisit my childhood. It seems to have a healing effect on me. And I like to write books that I would have loved to have at various ages. And my oversimplified way of describing this that I describe from time to time is you're 7 and then you're 8. The 7-year-old isn't gone. The 7-year-old is still there intact. The 8-year-old is there when you're 9 ad infinitum until you croak. So all of us carry within us our different aged selves. So it's not like I go back and write about my life, but I will start to get a clear sense of a moment. You know, it'll be tactile, it'll be sensory. You know, I'll smell things, I'll see dust motes in a sunbeam. It'll take me back to the back room in my parents' apartment in Chicago when I was, you know, 3 or something like that. And I'll get very in touch, and I get better and better at it through the years of going back to that kid who's still there, who was me. And then, you know, in some way, the book is created for that kid. And my theory being that there'll be other kids who have similar enough taste that they'll get it too.
Why do you think you get better at returning to memories from your childhood?
Practice. You know, it's like, I guess I haven't been psychoanalyzed because, one, I couldn't afford it, and other reasons too. But I imagine after a while...
You don't want to know, do you?
You sort of... I don't want anyone else to have anything to say about it. Uh-huh. I know plenty good because of my profession. I'm back there a lot, you know, and there's no end to the intercourse between your child self and your adult self. It never stops, and it motivates and conditions so many things we think and do as adults.
In speaking of your childhood, I was wondering, were you close with your parents?
Well, they were my parents. I was close to them. Close and frightened.
Frightened.
Listen, when you got a father that talks like this, doesn't matter what he's saying, and pointing with the finger, comes from Europe, you should be frightened.
Was he...
He was a gangster.
He was a gangster?
Well, he was a tough guy.
What did he do? What?
I don't know what he did. He wouldn't tell us, but I'll tell you this. In his office, in his dirty, messy office, he had a desk. And sometimes he'd let me come down. I'd sit while he made phone calls and hollered at people. I'd play with the things in his desk, which included 2 blackjacks. You know what is it, a blackjack, Terry?
Oh, yeah.
A sap? It's leather. It's plated leather. It's got a lead weight at one end, and it's sort of flexible. And there was a black one and a brown one. And I said, Daddy, what are these?
Those is blackjacks, honey.
I said, how come you got 2, one black and one brown? I said,
the black one is with the gray suit, and the brown one is with the blue suit.
So he did give me a sense of style, I feel.
Oh, that's really funny. I guess you never met any of the people he used it on.
I met his friends and colleagues. He might have used the blackjacks on them as well. They were like that. His own brother used to hire a truck periodically at night and back it up to my father's store and take everything out and sell it.
Wow. Huh. So what
did that in the old country. It was a traditional occupation. I should say, there's great stories by Isaac Babel. Do you know those? Benya Crick, the gangster in Odessa?
I don't.
Wonderful, wonderful. One of the great stylists, one of the great short story writers of the 20th century was this guy, Isaac Babel. And the collections are called Red Cavalry, I think. But he has a character called Benya Crick. And this is precisely how it was, because I heard the same stories from relatives. Insufficient employment in the ghetto, okay? Young Jewish men with nothing else to do would abstract things from delivery carts. Then they would write a formal business letter to the consignee saying, Reb so-and-so, by a series of circumstances not worth going into our hands has come a parcel belonging to you, we believe, which you may redeem at a set rate or expect a disappointment in your family life.
So,
and it was all done like that. And in fact, the name of the story is how it was done in Odessa. And I'm sitting in the funeral cortege, my father's funeral, and a wild cousin is telling me the same story in terms of my father's occupation on the other side.
So what did your father tell you about the business he was in?
Nothing. Now, he had a business, and in fact, he was scrupulously honest according to his lights. He was the kind of guy who'd come back a year later to give you the quarter that he owed you. And it's maybe because, and there's a story that upon arriving in this country, and I remember him saying to us, I asked him, what was your first impression of New York when you finally hit land? And he said, the size of the policeman, the average size of the New York City cop impressed him.
Was he mean to you?
He was not mean. He was cruel. There's a difference.
Right. Fair enough. In what ways was he cruel to you?
He was basically he's an old European father, so there was a lot of roaring and striking.
And did he think that that was good for you in the long run, or was he just sadistic?
Oh, he wasn't sadistic. He was more psychotic. We had a good relationship, I have to say. I enjoyed him, he enjoyed me. But he was nobody to mess with either.
Now, tell us something about your mother.
She was an awful person in her way, but she was pretty much quiet.
An awful person in her way.
Yeah.
What was so awful?
She's not worth talking about. She
really was awful.
I can't say I liked her at all.
Right. Was she mean to you?
She was mean in her way. She was. I would much rather have a bombastic, fisticuffs yelling father than. I don't want to talk about my mother. She was just awful. I have a hard time writing sympathetic mothers, but I force myself.
Does that stand in the way?
Yes, yeah, sometimes it does. You know, I mean, you know, you're in a position to get a couple of licks in, but then she's so pathetic that it's not that hard to forget about her.
Does that make it harder for you to make these kind of memory trips back to childhood?
No, the thing is, you know, it was a very chaotic childhood. My parents would disappear and go to nightclubs almost every night during the war. And they would always have a picture taken. And I would be awakened from sleep by my mother smelling of cigarettes and wearing a mink coat, cigarettes and perfume, giving me a hug at 3 a.m. And they would bring me as a souvenir a photo taken in the restaurant of all these people, the men with broken noses, you know, and the women, you know, dripping with pearls and furs. And they were out, they were, I think, heavily influenced by Nick and Nora Charles. And there was all manner of strange things going on. There was a couple who lived in the back room of one of these long, enormous Chicago apartments that goes on forever. In the back room lived a Polish anthropologist and her husband, who was a political radical. And the Polish anthropologist was under contract to the War Department to research psychological warfare versus Japan. So to sort of get into the Japanese ethos, she was cooking a Polish person's idea of Japanese food. She did all the cooking. So I was raised on a bizarre kind of Japanese-Polish cuisine, all manner of stuff. And I had a much older brother and sister who my mother had thrown in an orphanage at one point before she married my father. They'd been pulled out. They were living there. They kind of raised me. It was quite an interesting setup. I had a terribly good time. The fact that my parents were not necessarily good parents, and in other circumstances, I would have been taken away from them probably, didn't really signify too much. My half brother and half sister, as my sister puts it, had learned human values in the orphanage, and they were raising me, and it was such an interesting world. It was such an interesting neighborhood. The kids in the backyards. Classics comics were playing games based on 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and Mysterious Island and so forth. I had a rich childhood, and I was discovering cultural treasures all the time.
Daniel Pinkwater speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to our interview with Daniel Pinkwater. His latest book, the third installment of the Hoboken Chicken Stories, is called The Artsy Smartsy Club and will be published next month.
Now, I want to ask you a question about the name of a character in your new book, Looking for Bobowitz.
Yes.
And his name is Sean And depending on how you want to read the last name, it's either Ferguson or Fergesson. It's F-E-R-G-E-S-S-I-N.
Yes, he's a recurring character in other books.
Now that's, do you mean that as the Yiddish word forgotten or forgetting, Fergesson?
There's an earlier book, and this, it pains me to say, my first novel, Lizard Music, is the best book I ever wrote. Imagine my chagrin, 99 books later, still trying to match it. But that can happen, and it happened to me, and as you see, I'm taking it with good grace. And in it, there's a character named Shane Ferguson. And that, of course, is the classic joke, which is on the golf course or in the clubhouse, someone is paged. Shane Ferguson, this very Yiddish man, old man, goes to take the call. And when he comes back, his golfing partner says, your name is Shane Ferguson? We weren't introduced. He says, yes, that's my name is Shane Ferguson. And he says, this, you seem like an Eastern European Jewish person. He says, that's right, I am. So Shane, how do you? He said, well, when they asked me my name at Ellis Island, I was so confused. I said, Shane Ferguson, which means I have already forgotten. So this is an internal in-joke. There's all kinds of stuff, like raisins in the rice pudding in all my books, referring to things which are real, things which are not real but might be, and things which readers will recognize from other books. I can't help it. It's extra kicks. I just put them in. It doesn't hurt if you don't get them, but if you do get them, it just makes the rice pudding that much more enjoyable.
Now, you said that your first book was your best book.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
What was it about?
Lizard Music is about a kid whose parents take off on a trip and leave him in the care of his older sister, who takes off on a trip of her own, which leaves him all by himself and free to begin exploring. And it's the first book in which the suburban kid is magnetically drawn into the old city to look around and find things. And he's on a particular quest because he's discovered that at night, after the TV station goes off the air, it comes back on the air, and there are lizards, actual lizards, playing jazz. And he wants to find out more about it, and that leads him into the city, and he meets various people, and he has quite an adventure, and it's just such a perfect book. I didn't know that I'd ever be allowed to write another one, and I just hit the notes perfectly.
What a great fantasy.
It's a great book. It's a great book. It's considered a classic. It'll probably live after I do, and it should. And all my other stuff, I'm getting better. I'm making progress. I have that to try and match. I don't think I've matched it yet. This one doesn't. Looking for Bobowitz.
You used to illustrate your book, so I assume you illustrated the first one.
I started out to be an artist. I went to New York to crack the art world. And it took years for me to realize that this wasn't a good idea. And I started as an illustrator. I started wanting to be an illustrator and wound up illustrating my own text because I didn't have a text to illustrate. Got more interested in writing. I went to art school. I have a degree. I don't like to draw. It makes me nervous. I like to write. It's completely pleasurable. Some people think that that's one of the many reasons why I shouldn't be taken seriously, because you're supposed to suffer. I don't. But I suffered plenty doing illustrations. My wife is the daughter of a painter, my wife Jill. And this, her mother is on the order of mine, and said to her two talented daughters, you may not be artists. One day she walked into my office and I was sitting doing what I do, which is to say, staring off into the middle distance. And it's impossible to tell if I'm working or thinking or if I've died. So she, to see what was the case, she picked up a folder and said, what's this? You see? And I said, the story is supposed to be illustrated. And she said, how's about I do it? I said, fine, take a sketchbook, go illustrate, make drawings. And she came back in an hour with sketches, and they were just so wonderful that I called up the editor and said, look, this may seem off the wall to you, but instead of me illustrating the book, would you consider letting my wife try to? And she said, wonderful idea. Yes, we'll have Jill do it. We'll write up a different contract for her. Never having seen any of her work, It could only tell me how they felt about mine. And the fact is, she draws the way I would draw if I could really draw. I love her stuff. I just love it. And so I stopped illustrating because hers is so interesting and exciting, and it's such fun to see what she comes up with. She was writing some pretty good novels, but I'm not sure she'll be writing any more because I won't give her the time. I keep giving her projects of mine to do.
How long have you been married?
30-odd years or forever, whichever comes first.
That's a good track record.
Yes, especially since we got married 6 weeks after the day we met.
Wow.
And decided to get married 2 days after the day we met. And it's been clicking along ever since in its way.
Huh. Now, you don't have children.
No.
It too personal to ask whether that's intentional?
Who knows if it's intentional or ordained, but it works out that we don't have children, which gives us many kinds of freedom to do some things that we are able to do, not better than, but different than if you had children to worry about.
Did you want to be a father?
I have never felt a strong desire to be a father.
Some people might be surprised to hear that. Since you write for children, they might assume that, you know, it would be like your big goal in life to be a father.
No, it's my big goal in life to write for children.
Right. Well, Daniel Pinkwater, it was really great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was really great to talk with you.
Daniel Pinkwater, speaking last year with Terry Gross. The follow-up installment to his children's book, Looking for Babowitz, will be published next month. It's called The Artsy Smartsy Club. And he has a novel coming out next month as well, called The Education of Robert Nifkin. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel, Night and Day, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. And from Bantam, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Creating a Legacy of Physical and Emotional Health by Dr. Christiane Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Sarah Vowell on why she likes historical places that have some kind of disaster attached to them. Her new book, Assassination Vacation, is about her visits to gravesites and monuments honoring the first three assassinated U.S. presidents. Also, David Edelstein reviews Palindromes, the new film by Todd Solondz. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Sarah Vowell often reads her funny and perceptive essays on the public radio program This American Life. She also provided the voice of teen superhero Violet Parr in one of last year's most successful films, The Incredibles. If you know her work, then you know that she's immersed in music and movies. Her first collection of essays was even named after a line in The Godfather, "Take the cannoli." But her latest book draws on her life as a history buff. Assassination Vacation is her obsessive and funny account of her tours of sites that mark the lives and deaths of America's first three presidential victims of assassination, Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley. Here's an excerpt, read by Sarah, from the audiobook edition.
The bright side to researching the first three presidential assassinations is that my interest is optional, a choice. One man who makes cameo appearances in all three stories was not so lucky. Abraham Lincoln's oldest son, Robert Todd Lincoln, was in close proximity to all three murders like some kind of jinxed Zealot of Doom. The young man who wept at his father's deathbed in 1865 was only a few feet away when James A. Garfield was shot in a train station in 1881. In 1901, Robert arrived in Buffalo mere moments after William McKinley fell. Robert Todd Lincoln's status as a presidential death magnet weighed on him. Late in life, when he was asked to attend some White House function, he grumbled,
"If only they knew, they wouldn't want me there."
Sarah Vowell, with the final line from Conan O'Brien, from the audiobook edition of her new book, Assassination Vacation. She spent many vacations touring historical sites and devotes a considerable part of her life to reading about history. That's what led to her previous book, The Partly Cloudy Patriot, published in 2002. That's when Terry most recently spoke with Sarah Vowell.
Sarah, you love history, and you write about that in your first essay in your new collection, and this essay finds you at Gettysburg on the 137th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address, so you're there for another reading of it. There's a paragraph here I'd like you to read about loving history.
I could say that I've come to Gettysburg as a rubbernecking tourist, that I've shown up to force myself to mull over the consequences of a war I never think about, because that would make a better story. A gum-chewing, youngish person who says like too much comes face to face with the horrors of war and learns something. But, like, this story isn't like that. Fact is, I think about the Civil War all the time, every day. I can't even use a cotton ball to remove my eye makeup without spacing out about slavery's favorite cash crop. And that line from Lincoln's second inaugural address that it may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. Well, that, and why does black eyeliner smudge way more than brown?
Sarah Vowell, reading from The Partly Cloudy Patriot. In your book, you write about how you spoke to a friend of yours about your love for historical places and your emphasis on historical places that have some kind of disaster attached to them.
Uh-huh.
And the friend you talked to about this is somebody who counsels people who survived torture.
Right.
So what did you tell her? What did she tell you?
Well, I called her right after I got back from Salem, and I had a really good time in Salem, but I felt kind of guilty about it. You know, like, one of my favorite things that happened in Salem was that I was at this gift shop, and a guy in the gift shop asked the cashier, "Hey, you got any witchcraft trivets?" And she said, "You mean a trivet with a witch on it?" And I just thought that was really funny, you know, that this guy wanted, you know, that this, I don't know, I mean, it was horrible. This horrible thing happened here and 20 innocent people were executed, but this guy wanted to remember it by buying a thing he could protect his table from a burning saucepan with. And that just cracked me up, but then I felt bad about it. And then I had such a good time in Salem. And I mean, it's a really pretty town and there's a lot to do. And you know, just it's kind of kooky, like the Witch Dungeon Museum and things like that. And so I got home and I felt guilty because, you know, ultimately this whole town's tourism industry is based around the fact that 20 innocent people were executed. And so I called my friend Kate, and Kate is a psychologist with the program for survivors of torture. And she's one of the funniest people I know, but it's weird that she has this torture job she talks to people with actual historical problems. So I called her with mine, which was, why do I go to these places and why don't I ever go anywhere fun? Why don't I go to Hawaii or Martha's Vineyard or the Caribbean? Why, you know, like I went to the homestead of this elderly woman who was executed for witchcraft this weekend and had a great time. What is wrong with me? And she basically told me Well, she said it's not denial, it's the opposite of denial. And her idea was that I go to these places and I enjoy them, but that my humor about them is full of, she called it, anxious giggles, and that I use my, that I have an uneasy relationship with American history, which I do because it's really bloody and dark besides being inspiring, and that I go to these places and joke around and stuff, and I use humor as a way of managing my anxiety.
How does that strike you?
That seems about right.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I manage my anxiety a lot, I guess.
Sarah Vowell speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. Her new book is Assassination Vacation. We'll hear more from Sarah after this break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Sarah Vowell, a familiar voice on the public radio program This American Life. Her new book is Assassination Vacation, a one-woman tour of the sites and monuments devoted to Presidents Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley. In 2000, Sarah spoke with Terry about her book Take the Cannoli. In that book, she wonders why the film The Godfather kidnapped her life, although on the surface it had nothing to do with her. She's a feminist, not Italian. She grew up in small towns and was raised in the Pentecostal faith. Here's a reading from the book.
I am a gunsmith's daughter. I like to call my parents' house, located on a quiet residential street in Bozeman, Montana, the United States of Firearms. Guns were everywhere, the so-called pretty ones like the circa 1850 walnut muzzle loader hanging on the wall, Dad's clients' fixer-uppers leaning into corners, an entire rack right next to the TV. I had to move revolvers out of my way to make room for a bowl of Rice Krispies on the kitchen table. I was 11 when we moved into that Bozeman house. We had never lived in town before, and this was a college town at that. We came from Oklahoma, a dusty little Muskogee County nowhere called Braggs. My parents' property there included an orchard, a horse pasture, and a couple of acres of woods. I knew our lives had changed one morning not long after we moved to Montana when, during breakfast, my father heard a noise and jumped out of his chair. Grabbing a BB gun, he rushed out the front door, and standing in the front yard, he started shooting at crows. My mother sprinted after him, screaming, "Pat, you might ought to check, but I don't think they do that up here." From the look on his face, she might as well have told him that his American citizenship had been revoked. He shook his head, mumbling, "Why, shooting crows is a national pastime, like baseball and apple pie." Personally, I preferred baseball and apple pie. I looked up at those crows flying away and thought, "I'm going to like it here."
That's Sarah Vowell reading an essay from Take the Cannoli, Stories from the New World. Now, in a lot of your essays, the fact that you're from Muskogee and then at age 11 moved with your family to Montana comes up a lot. And it's almost as if you think you're from another country than many of your readers. Do you feel that way?
Well, I guess I keep trying to stick up for the flyover land voice because a lot of people in with access to the media are coastal types, and a lot of them are sort of East Coast establishment, went to really good schools kind of people. And I guess I always bring it up because, well, for two reasons, just to say, you know, we exist and we have things to say, but also I felt like an immigrant as a child moving from a small town, Oklahoma, to a college town. I mean, we did move to Montana, but it was a very college town atmosphere, and that was incredibly foreign to me and also incredibly exciting. So I guess I have two kind of cultural references there. As a child, we were Pentecostal, and so I guess music has always been one of the most important things in my life, and as a child, country music was very important to me. And then when I moved to Montana, that's when I sort of eventually fell in with the kind of 80s indie rock underground, where I guess the people who were important to me were people like the poet Allen Ginsberg, or I was a huge Philip Glass fan as a teenager, things like that. And then when I, right towards the end of high school and the beginning of college, and I stayed in Montana for college, I guess rock and roll kind of took me over. And that was sort of my introduction to fun.
Now, you grew up Pentecostal and went to a Pentecostal church when you lived near Muskogee. What were the services like when you were young?
They were very holy roller. There was a lot of speaking in tongues, and it was pretty fire and brimstone, you know. When we moved to Montana, we went to this kind of non-denominational church, about which my mother said, too much teaching, not enough preaching, because it was definitely in Oklahoma, you were preached to. And yeah, there was a lot of yelling, and there was even finger pointing. You know, the preacher would be in the middle of a sermon, and he would point at, like, he would, I remember once he pointed at this very nice man named Bob Brewster and said, "You're still smoking, Bob Brewster." And, I was just scared to death that I would ever do anything wrong and get, you know, yelled at in church with that finger pointing at me. And then, the one thing that was great about it was music. I mean, we sang all those old hymns, you know, like, I guess I'll Fly Away was my favorite one. And, they're very musical, people. So that was a definite saving grace.
I remember when I interviewed the writer Walter Kern, who was brought up as a Mormon, he said that you can't really understand the pull of, say, heavy metal music and its satanic imagery unless you were raised in a fundamentalist community where the devil was the only real rebel that you knew. Do you have similar feelings to that?
That's interesting. Well, the devil was not the only rebel I knew. I mean, because it was a horribly gossipy town, and there were constant, I mean, there's no way you can live up to those standards of not drinking, not smoking, not falling in love with the wrong person, not having sex, you know. There were, everyone was a rebel in that sense, because no one was, I mean, there were very few people who were cutting the mustard that way, and they were, to me, they were all women, you know. That's why I always had this dream that I would know the rapture came because all the women would be gone, because all the horrible men and ill-behaved children would be left behind. I do see the world kind of in good versus evil terms. And I, even though I don't believe in that devil anymore, I am kind of always looking for them. And also, one thing I learned after I got out of there and after I started completely questioning those beliefs is that true evil often has a pretty face. And I think that actually definitely comes from the whole Antichrist theory. You know, they always told us the Antichrist is probably going to be blonde and handsome and nice and funny and smart and sweet, and to always look behind that face to see what's going on. And I mean, in terms of heavy metal, I guess they aren't heavy metal, but the big demons of my 70s childhood there were Kiss, and they were the Antichrist. You know, they were supposed to be knights in Satan's service, and we had to pray against them. I think they were the only people we ever prayed against. You know, we were constantly praying for, but they were just seemed they were deemed irredeemable, and we were to stay away from them, and I was just scared to death of them. And you know, meanwhile, my mom is letting me listen to, like, Loretta Lynn's The Pill, you know, which is, I guess, fine because it was country music, but it was a song about, you know, putting on the hot pants because now she's got birth control. And then years later in college, I had a roommate who was an old Kiss kid, and I heard Kiss for the first time, you know, like that love song, Beth, and I thought, this was the problem. You know, it's just totally candy rock and way more acceptable than some of those sexy country songs I was allowed to listen to.
So you were praying against Kiss without even ever having heard them?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
I think you left organized religion at about age 16. Did you feel when you left, it left any kind of gap in your life that you needed to replace with something else?
Oh, it was just a hole that's still there. I mean, I guess it's a rarer and rarer experience as the world becomes more secularized. But it was, I think I'm still getting over it because I always had little doubts, even as a little kid, because a lot of the things don't make sense, you know, especially if you read the Bible. Partly, I always had problems because I'm so gullible. I believed everything. I couldn't understand how you could be a Christian and be a racist because Jesus said, love everybody and preach to the whores. Or I remember in my mom's ladies prayer meeting, we had to hold hands in a circle and pray for the local bar to be shut down, the little Oklahoma bar. But I remember, like, thinking, didn't Jesus turn water into wine? You know, I just didn't understand any of that. So I always had little nagging doubts, but I talked to God constantly, I guess, until I was 16. And I was therefore never lonely. I mean, I was always kind of a loner, but I always felt like I had someone to talk to. And then once I lost that, it was a few years before I kind of got used to just thinking to myself instead of talking to the supreme being or something.
So there was a kind of vacuum.
I guess,
what else had to change when your religion, when your faith and your religion ended?
Well, you have to figure out how to be good without having hell hanging over your head.
Uh-huh.
And in a way, it's harder, I think, to figure out how to be a moral person when you don't have a book telling you how to be moral. And so that was an interesting question. This all, of course, kind of happened simultaneously with the existentialism chapter or the existentialism unit in high school English class.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of those teen angst books I was reading then too, you know, things like The Stranger by Camus or something, ask those sort of questions. How can there be morality in the absence of God? And basically, it eventually occurred to me that, you know, things like the Ten Commandments it's a very good idea. Like, those are good rules and I believe in them, and I don't have to believe in impending doom to decide not to sleep with someone else's husband, you know.
Sarah Vowell speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. Her new book, Assassination Vacation, has just been published. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Palindromes, the new film from the director who brought you Happiness. This is Fresh Air. The writer and director Todd Solondz has been called the bad vibe bard of northern New Jersey, turning out bracing satirical movies on such subjects as pedophilia and miscegenation. His new film, Palindromes, is calculated to disturb both the pro-choice and anti-abortion camps, as well as everyone in between. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Todd Solondz is one of the few writer-directors who has earned an NC-17 rating without nudity or profanity. His films are just so conceptually grotesque, you wouldn't want to show them to anyone below the age of, I was going to say 40, but that would be too glib. I actually respect Solondz's purity of vision. No matter how much his distributors plead for a slightly softer product, he'll always show us the world through dung-colored glasses. Maybe he deserves a new rating. NRD, not recommended for persons depressed or suicidal? Solondz begins Palindromes with an off-camera suicide, or perhaps I should call it an artistic filicide, the funeral of Dawn Wiener, the heroine of his breakthrough feature Welcome to the Dollhouse. So the whole movie is colored by the grim knowledge that the life of little bespectacled Dawn ended badly. She's held up as a warning for this movie's protagonist, Dawn's cousin Aviva. Note that the name is a palindrome. It's the same backwards or forwards. Let me describe Aviva. She's black and heavy, as well as white and skinny and red-haired. She's also a boy, and Jennifer Jason Leigh, which is to say that Solondz has cast her with seven different actors to encourage us to identify with her regardless of our race or body type, and also to suggest the immutability of personality. Fat, skinny, black, white, this is always the same Aviva, especially since Solondz has directed each actor to have the same mopey-dopey affect. In the first episode, right after Dawn's funeral, Aviva is a young black girl played by Imani Sledge-Toon. The mom, Joyce, is played by the wonderful Ellen Barkin, who's shown up less and less on screen since marrying a billionaire.
Oh, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay.
I don't want to be like Dawn. I don't want to be like her or end up like her.
Aviva, no. Shh. Don't worry. You and Dawn are completely different.
Really?
Your cousin was a troubled child, a middle child. Her parents didn't love her the way your father and I love you.
Why not?
I don't know. Maybe if she hadn't grown obese, if she'd gone to a dermatologist, something.
You can hear the distinctive Solondz voice. It's not comic exactly, but it's condescending and apt to flare suddenly into cruel caricature. A few years after that scene, a post-pubescent Aviva single-mindedly gets herself pregnant, whereupon the pressure from her parents to abort the baby is relentless and hysterical. At the clinic, the anti-abortion protesters fall to their knees and exhort her to turn back, but Joyce guides the dazed Aviva into the doctor's waiting stirrups. I won't tell you what happens, only that Aviva's subsequent odyssey takes her right into the bosom of a floridly religious and anti-abortion conclave overseen by a dimply woman known as Mama Sunshine, played by Deborah Monk. This is the central section of Palindromes, and Aviva is played by Sharon Wilkins, a morbidly obese young African-American actress with a classically pretty face. Mama Sunshine's house teems with smiling, singing, dancing, disabled kids, real ones in many cases. They're not photographed insensitively, but there's a circus menagerie quality to the entire episode that goes to the heart of Solondz's World of Freaks aesthetic. Solondz is committed to shock, but not in some punky nya-nya way. He's more like a doctoral student, solemnly presenting the innards of various animals and silently enjoying your discomfort. His characters are dead to him, not just limited, but incapable of transcending their limitations. Backwards and forwards, it's all the same. There's no learning from mistakes, no awareness of anything outside one's own warped subjectivity, no epiphanies, unless you count as an epiphany the realization that you're never going to have an epiphany. It should be said that Solondz is an equal opportunity misanthrope. He loathes the garishly self-centered rah-rah abortion mom, but also her fanatical opposition. Only the children have souls, but they are hideously vulnerable and prone to being manipulated like puppets. Palindromes is a thesis movie, almost a manifesto for despair. But like most one-sided theses, its bad vibes don't linger. Have dinner with friends, hug a child, pick up a good book, and poof, life returns with a happy vengeance.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. This is normally where I'd read the closing credits for Fresh Air, but this isn't a normal day. So as guest host, I'm turning over the microphone to a special guest, the regular host of Fresh Air, Terry Gross.
Thanks, David. I'm here to say goodbye and thanks to our producer, Naomi Person, who's moving to New York to work at public radio station WNYC. Although I've said my share of sad goodbyes to wonderful Fresh Air staff members over the years, it's particularly difficult to express what we as a staff are feeling today. Naomi joined Fresh Air in 1987, just a few weeks before we made the transition from being a local program to being a national one. Since then, Naomi has been essential in making our way through major and minor crises and in celebrating all the little and big milestones. She started off editing our critics and commentators and then became an interview producer, focusing on film, theater, and television. We have her to thank for getting us such guests as Ray Charles, John Travolta, Dustin Hoffman, Uta Hagen, Martin Scorsese, Al Pacino, Jodie Foster, and Gene Hackman. Get this, yesterday marked Naomi's 18th anniversary at Fresh Air. A baby born on the day Naomi arrived would be ready for college today. All I can say is, we're preparing to cope with the absence she will leave in our program and in our lives. But she'll remain an important part of Fresh Air's identity. We wish her the best in her new home. And to our colleagues at WNYC, we say, congratulations. I'm feeling sad, David. Why don't you read the credits?
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Joan Tuohy-Westman,
and Naomi Person. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from PBS, presenting Deep Jungle on Nature. Jungle exploration begins Sunday night at 8, 7 Central. Local air times may vary. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the most violent 8 seconds in sports. We talk with former bull riding champ Gary Lafeu about what it's like to ride an angry 1,000-pound bull who wants you off his back. Now Lafeu teaches bull riding at his ranch, and he's a consultant on HBO's Deadwood, where he punches up scripts and helps David Milch create the authentic cowboy ambiance. Join us for the next Fresh Air,